shared space with a bus terminal. There was, not 10 feet from where I'd emerge from the tidy bushes surrounding the whole space, a bus with the luggage doors open on both sides. Even as I noticed it, attendants closed the doors on the far side. I jumped in the near side and scrambled over bags and suitcases before dropping into an empty space and stillness. I lay there panting as quietly as I could until the doors closed. 5 minutes later, the bus lumbered forward in a wave of diesel fumes, and I took a deep breath. Safe. Relief washed over me, and I put my head down. I slept. I dreamed of Adam. I sprawled awkwardly over a chair shaped for a person in my coyote body, my muzzle on Adam's lap. His strong hand rested on my back. I moved so I could see his face. He looked tired. I think we were on an airplane, which made no sense at all, but it was only an impression. Everything except for Adam was pretty vague in the way that dreams sometimes are.
"There you are," he said. What did you get yourself into this time?"
"Coyotes can't talk."
"Mercy," he said.
Sometimes I've been known to use the not talk thing to my advantage. He sounded like he was mad at me. I was tired. The pads on the bottom of my feet, tough enough to run over the desert, had not fared so well running over blacktop all night. My shoulder hurt. My jaw hurt. My heart hurt. I was stuck in a luggage compartment without food. My stomach was pretty sure my throat had been cut. I put my muzzle back on his lap and closed my eyes. He was very still for a moment.
"Not doing so good, huh?"
he said softly, running his hands over my sides gently before he touched both sides of my face in a caress that was both soothing and possessive.
"Sorry. I've been very worried."
Adam doesn't swear in front of women or children if he can help it. A product of a childhood in the 50s, or abnormally good manners. Take your pick. He bent over me, put his head down on top of mine, and I heard him inhale as if he were breathing me in.
"Are you okay?"
I wiggled a little closer to him, but I didn't open my eyes. Apparently that was enough of an answer, because he exhaled and relaxed.
"All right then,"
he said.
"I'll tell you what I know."
He sat up, but his hand stayed on me.
"You just disappeared, sweetheart. We found the SUV and the stolen semi that hit it. Found your blood on the seat. That was rough because, Mercy, it was a lot of blood. But we couldn't find you. The gas station was deserted. We think the clerk belonged to the vampires, that they had been waiting for you to go there by yourself. It was so close to home you'd feel safe, and that would give him a chance to act. We might have been at a dead end, but things really got interesting when we talked to Marsilia."
I raised my head and looked at him, but he was staring at something I couldn't see.
"She'd gotten an email," he told me, "implying that you were being held to persuade her to present herself before the..."
He stopped here.
"I am informed that speaking his name or title might allow him to eavesdrop because we are speaking via a witch's spell rather than our bond. Do you know who I mean?"
I nodded, disconcerted by the idea of a witch spell. Adam's hands tightened painfully.
"Does he have you?"
Adam asked urgently, and I shook my head.
"You got away? Where are you? Are you all right? Are you safe?"
he asked. I would have said something then. But I was in coyote form, and I didn't have the faintest idea how to answer any of his questions. His nostrils flared, and he frowned at me.
"I smelled diesel. I thought it was just you, but, Mercy, are you on a bus?"
he asked. But he was gone before I could answer, the quiet dream blown to bits by the abrupt sound of hissing brakes. The noise and rough jolting brought me back to the dark underbelly of the luggage compartment, which was a cold substitute for Adam's lap. I stood up. My legs had trouble compensating for the wallow as the bus rolled over speed bumps, curbs, bodies, or something that lifted up one side, then the other a couple of times. I didn't know how long I'd been asleep. Not very long, I thought. I would have been stiffer if it had been more than a half hour or so. Not long enough to be safe from the Lord of Night. I waited, and when the bus stopped, I readied myself. When the luggage doors opened, I dashed out as quickly as I could. The bus attendant cried out as I ran by him, but this was a huge station, and I quickly lost myself among the buses and passengers towing luggage. A man reading a book crossed my path, and I slowed down, walking at his heel for a dozen yards, until the pack magic settled lightly around me and I became less interesting. I could feel the lessened pressure at the back of my neck as people quit looking at me. Pack magic would help, but I'd have to do my best to blend in because it was weak. We moved past a bright yellow bus just as a woman reached up to close the cargo area, but paused as something caught her attention. It was too good a chance to miss. I broke smoothly away from the man I'd been trailing and slipped unseen into the luggage compartment. I found a pair of big beige duffel bags and stretched out between them, just another beige lump to human eyes. The luggage bay doors closed. I stayed still until the bus was moving, then stayed still some more as it turned a corner and picked up speed. I had to stay still, or I was afraid I would lose my battle with panic. I'd assumed that the Lord of Night had taken me to Yakima or Walla Walla. Both were within a reasonable travel distance of the Tri-Cities, and both had gently rolling hills and vineyards. When I'd been running my hardest to stay ahead of the werewolf, I hadn't been paying attention to much beyond generalities. But the voices at the bus station hadn't been speaking English. They'd been speaking Italian. I wasn't in Yakima or Walla Walla. I wasn't in Washington or even in the U.S. The Lord of Night had taken me to Italy. And that was the reason I couldn't reach Adam or the pack through the various bonds I had to them as soon as I was free of Bonarata's magic circle. I wasn't sure how far Italy was from my home, but my liberal arts education told me that the world was roughly 25,000 miles around, and that Italy was about a quarter of the world away. I called it 6,000 miles, give or take 1,000 miles. I was in the belly of a bus in Italy, alone, naked, and penniless, also without a passport. In a place that a coyote was likely to be noticed because coyotes aren't exactly native to Europe. I thought a little more and added, "Can't speak the language," to my woes. I'd never traveled out of the country, except that summer road trip to Mexico with Char, my college roommate. Char spoke fluent Spanish, so my bits and pieces hadn't made me completely helpless. I put my head down and felt sorry for myself for a long while. Then I pulled on my big girl pants, which were figurative at this point, and started dealing with the situation as it stood. In front of me and behind me was a solution to my nakedness problem, and I had no room to be squeamish. I shifted back to my human self and started opening luggage. It took me a while to find someone who was reasonably close to me in size. I didn't want to strand her with not enough clothes, so I took the bare minimum. I'd found a notebook and pen in someone else's duffel bag and left a note in the address and phone number of Adam's business, as well as a detailed list of what I'd taken from the suitcase, a copy of which I kept. I found a pair of tennis shoes that fit in another suitcase, along with 20 euros. There had been maybe 200 euros in the suitcase, but my conscience, already pushed to the brink, could only deal with 20. I left a note for her, too. I had no idea how long this bus ride was going to be, though the luggage suggested that most people weren't planning on a short trip. Even so, I hurried so that I wouldn't be caught in the middle of my theft. I found an empty backpack, not a sturdy, can-hold-all-your-college-textbooks kind of pack, more of an I-don't-want-to-carry-a-purse-and-think-pink-lace-and-flowers-are-pretty pack. I thought it was pretty, too, if not really appropriate to anyone over the age of 7. But my coyote self could carry it, and it would hold the fruits of my heist job, so I took it. Stealing was quick. Writing all the notes took a lot longer. I was tucking the last note in when I noticed an e-reader sticking out of a compartment in the suitcase I'd taken the shoes from. I was pretty sure most e-readers had internet capability, even old ones like this one. I added it to the list of things I owed the nice woman who was going to be short a pair of tennis shoes, too, when she arrived at her destination. I was sorry for it, but I'd make it up to her as soon as I could. If I could. If I couldn't, if I didn't get myself out of this, Adam would know I would want these people compensated for the things I took. I packed everything in the flowery backpack and pulled it into the far corner of the bus. Then I changed back into the coyote and curled up in the corner, the metal of the bus's walls on either side of me. I'd grown used to feeling safe again, ever since Adam and I had become a couple. Okay, vampires, trolls, and a host of other villains that ranged from terrifying to scary had tried to kill me on a fairly regular basis, but Adam had my back. I hadn't realized how much I craved it until it was gone. Again. I thought I was safe before. I'd left most of the supernatural behind me when I'd left the Maroc's pack at 16. I'd gone to college, had decided that being a mechanic suited me better than teaching. For nearly 10 years I had lived in my trailer, had gone to work every day, and no one had tried to kill me. I'd felt like I didn't need anyone at my back. Not even when my world had started to fill with the affairs of the supernatural community had I lost my ability to find a place of safety, a home. But no one is really safe. Not ever. Afterward, after I picked up the pieces and glued them back together with a bit of hope and trust and fairy dust, I found another place to be home and safe. I paused in momentary horror. Had I married Adam just so I could feel safe? The panic lasted only for a moment, because I knew better. I'd had hours and hours of counseling with a pretty awesome counselor. Part of it was to address some bad things that had happened, but part of it was so that I could choose Adam. Because I chose him, and not because I knew that anything that came after me would have to go through him. But still, I had thought I was safe. The Lord of Night had come to my home ground and taken me there, then hauled me to Italy, as if the pack, as if all of my allies were no obstacle at all. He'd extracted me as cleanly as if I'd hopped on his airplane, because no way had he brought me here on a commercial plane, of my own volition. I'd had some time to think while I ran. My current version of why Buonarrota had brought me here went like this. He'd wanted to bring me here, thinking that I was Marsilia's. Because the thought that Adam and the pack could be cooperating without her being in charge just never occurred to him. I was a piece on a chessboard he'd decided Marsilia was the queen of. He'd taken me, who Wolf had told him was the most powerful of Marsilia's associates, to show her how powerless she was. I don't know what he'd have done if I were the werewolf he'd originally thought me, but his little pet werewolf was enough to make me wary. She'd smelled off, smelled sick, the kind of sick that made my coyote decide something wasn't good to eat. I had other versions of why Buonarrota had stolen me, but none of them made sense, including that one. Buonarrota was smarter than that. He had to be to have lived as long as he had. I really was certain that Marsilia was involved somehow. There had been something about the way he'd looked at me when he told me he hadn't wanted to kill Marsilia, so he hadn't broken the bond I shared, supposedly, with her. I shivered, though the bus wasn't particularly cold, and my summer fur coat could have protected me in the heaviest blizzard likely to fall in Lombardy. He'd thought that I was bound to Marsilia. I hated that the word for what the vampires did to their victims was the same word that described what was between Adam and me. Between the pack and me. My understanding, from the things I'd learned since Adam and I were bound as mates, was that all magical bonds are formed from the same sort of magic. Humans have those kinds of bonds too, but theirs are softer and more fragile, breakable. Like most things, pack bonds and mate bonds could be twisted, but by their nature, they encouraged empathy because they are emotional links. They were bonds between equals, even the bond between the pack and its alpha. The alpha had a job to do, but it didn't make him more important than the most submissive of the wolves in the pack. Adam was of the opinion that he was less important. We agreed to disagree. The bond between a vampire and his victim, I say his because the vampire who owned me, and that was exactly the right word, was a him, put the vampire in the driver's seat. The vampire could, if he so chose, make his pet do anything, feel anything. Whenever the vampire decided to, he could take away his victim's free will, and the victim might not even know. The kiss doesn't always work. Stefan told me that it was almost impossible to take a werewolf the way they could take humans because of the pack bonds. The Buonarrota had succeeded in doing so had added to his legend. There were people who were difficult to break. But given time, a strong vampire could control most any human he wanted to. Stefan told me he didn't know if that was true between us, but that he would not test it. I trusted Stefan. Even so, Stefan owned me. He had saved my life by claiming me, and I'd agreed to it. But I thought it was broken, gone, thought my ties to Adam and the pack had erased it, because Stefan had wanted me to believe it. Apparently, because I'd taken the bond willingly, it wasn't something Stefan could break, even if he wanted to. Knowing Stefan as I did, I was willing to believe that. The Lord of Night had tried to break it, and failed. Or so he said. My heartbeat picked up, and my mouth dried as I opened it and panted in fear. Of course he would lie. He lied a lot. I couldn't remember now if I'd been watching for lies while he spoke of the bond I shared with a vampire. I'd been paying attention to the jealousy he'd displayed. Had he lied? Was he even now in my head waiting to give me orders? To take me from Marsilia would have been a better lesson than to have his wolf kill me trying to escape. I had only his word that he hadn't done it. Hadn't I done what he wanted when I escaped? I'd known he wanted me to try it. What if he hadn't wanted me to die at the fangs of his pet werewolf as I'd first thought? What if this was his plan? That I'd escape, think I was free, get back to the pack, and destroy them because I belonged to Buonarrota? That story unfortunately made better sense than some sort of unrequited jealousy as a motivation. Had Buonarrota broken the tie between Stefan and me? Had he been able to do something that Stefan couldn't? Was I a slave of the Lord of Night? Since learning it still existed, I had never tested the bond between Stefan and me. Just the thought of that tie made me wake up in a cold-blooded sweat, understanding exactly how a trapped wolf could chew off a paw to escape. The bus continued to rumble at a consistent speed, unimpressed by my panic. I needed to find the bond between Stefan and me and make sure Buonarrota hadn't done something to it, something that would turn me into his creature. I didn't even really know how to look. But even as I thought that, I knew I had a stepping-off place. After Adam brought me into the pack bonds, I'd had a bad incident because a couple of the members of the pack were able to manipulate me through them. After that, Adam taught me how to deal with pack magic and the bonds. Part of that process was learning to see the bonds in my head. I closed my eyes, and after a fairly tough and lengthy struggle, calmed down enough to find the light meditative state Adam had taught me to help me negotiate the pack bonds, as well as the mate bond between him and me. Eventually, I stood on the battered stage of my old high school, the one in Portland. The floor was lit by a single spotlight, the one just over the control booth that sat in the middle of the balcony seats. I knew it was there, but caught in the spotlight's glare, I couldn't see it. The boards under my feet had been polished at one time. But years of student productions, of rolling the risers and the piano in and out, had left the old floor scarred and rough under my bare feet. Though I was wearing my coyote shape in real life, here in my mind, I was looking for human beings, so I was in my human shape, naked, because naked made me feel vulnerable, and I couldn't seem to find the safe space I needed to allow me to go clothed. Darkness gathered at the edges of the stage and covered the auditorium in shadows that my eyes couldn't penetrate. But I wasn't here to explore my memory of high school. I looked down at myself and patted the tattoo on my belly for a minute. There was nothing magical about the tattoo. It was just a paw print. A coyote paw print, no matter what Adam said. But it centered me. It was at the center of me, a symbol of the coyote within. My fingers came down for the 100th or 200th time and hit a thick rope that wrapped all the way around me. It was a rope that should have been too big to tie around me, but as my perceptions of it changed, clarified, I could see that it wove around my upper torso like a bulletproof vest, if bulletproof vests were made of silk rope. I could not feel its weight, but here in that place between waking and sleep, it was warm and comforting, and it stretched into a gray mist that had somehow gathered in the darkness surrounding me. I bent my head and pulled the rope to my nose. It smelled like Adam, and I touched it to my cheek. Under my hand, it felt alive and, well, I could faintly feel Adam's resolve, his stress, and his fear. Gently, I let the rope fall away from my hands. I was not looking for my mate bond. The pack bonds were woven through my vest, the warp to Adam's weave, fluffier than the silk that was my bond with Adam. My pack bonds came in the shape of colorful Christmas garlands. Far lighter than the bond between Adam and me, they sparkled and shimmered as I moved. They stretched out for me in a braided cable about half as big as the mate bond. Like that bond, the pack bonds disappeared in the mist of distance. When I touched them, I could feel very faintly the lives of the wolves on the other end. But I wasn't looking for the pack, either. I stood in as neutral a position as I could, feet apart, knees bent, arms at my sides, closed my dream soft's eyes and thought, Stefan. I pictured him in my head, a moderately tall man with dark hair and eyes, very Italian, I'd always thought him. His smile was warm and his posture varied. When he paid attention, he slumped a little and stomped a little. When he didn't, he had the same sort of ramrod straight posture that Adam had. They'd both been soldiers as young men. He was a dangerous man who was able to put it aside and joke and laugh as he helped me repair his van. A powerful vampire who knew ASL and unselfconsciously watched Scooby-Doo. When I was done, I opened my eyes, and he stood in front of me, a statue without life. I walked all the way around him, looking for something, anything that tied us together. A sparkle teased at my senses, but I couldn't find it, and was afraid I was making it up. I closed my eyes again and ran my hands over my neck. After a few minutes, my fingers tangled in a necklace. It was gossamer fine and cool against my fingers. I searched for a clasp and found instead a small circle of metal that gathered the strands of necklace together, and attached to it was another chain. I opened my eyes as my fingers followed the chain out far enough from under my chin that I could see it. A fine silver chain lay in my hands, and once I saw it, I could see that it led to the hands of the version of Stefan I had on my stage. It looked so fragile. I tried to break it, but it wouldn't break or bend, not with anything I could bring to bear on it in my mind. I fought and fought, pulling frantically on the necklace collar around my neck until blood stained the chain running down it from my neck and from my fingers. "Shh," said a cool voice. "Shh, you're breaking my heart, Kara." I froze. Then I looked up from the now heavy chain to my image of Stefan, which crouched next to me on the stage.
"I promised," he told me. "I promised not to tug on the leash. I promised. Don't hurt yourself so. I keep my promises, Mercy."
His voice flowed over me, a friend's voice. I was so alone. His voice was like a warm blanket over my nakedness. It gave me strength to allow my fingers to release the chain. I sat up. My intention was to find the bond, I remembered, not to fight it. I took my terror, the atavistic fear of a trapped animal, and stuffed it back so I could think. I'd been looking for it to make sure that it tied me to the right vampire. "Who are you?" I asked him. "I need to be certain. I remembered that Adam hadn't used his name, so I switched it up a little. "Marsilia's master took me. I need to make sure that this, I indicated the leash between us that now resembled a rusty lumber chain instead of fine jewelry, is between you and me, that he didn't break this bond and replace it with one of his own. Stefan sat back on his heels and tilted his head.
A fair question, he said. If he held your bonds, he could.
He frowned, then pulled a knife out of a pocket and sliced his palm. He pressed it against the chain he held, and the red drops landed on the metal. There were only 5 or 6 drops, but gradually the whole chain turned rust red. When those red links came close to me, I touched them, and the faded, cartoonish figure of Stefan solidified into the vampire himself. His gaze traveled around at my stage and the fog, at the 2 cords that disappeared into the mist, and smiled at me.
Good to see you. This won't last long, but while it does, I have some things to tell you. Adam told us that you got away. Keep running. Don't trust anyone. We'll find you, all right? We're on our way to Italy. Once we are there, your ties to Adam should start working again, at least well enough for him to find you. He says that without the pack nearby, you should expect your ties to him and to the pack to remain weak until he is quite close. We can beat him, I think, Marsilio's old master, but only if you stay free. And don't contact me this way again. He can't, probably can't, listen in. But he might be able to feel our conversation and follow the thread of it to you.
He was still Buonarrota. I knew that without Stefan's using his name. Stefan looked at the chain and said,
Really? This looks like something you'd find in a dungeon.
I opened my mouth to explain about the necklace, but changed my mind at the last moment and shrugged instead. Scooby-Doo would be impressed. He smiled, and I was alone again, holding the fine chain that now disappeared into the mists. I took 2 deep breaths and returned to the belly of the diesel beast that was carrying me to some unknown destination. We'd been traveling for a while. From the angle of the floor and the swaying as we turned one way, then the other, we were traveling through mountains. It was unlikely that I was going to find myself in Milan when the bus stopped. The farther I could manage to travel, the better off I'd be. I was still tied to Stefan, and not the Lord of Night. Stefan was a vampire. He killed people to survive. It was true that he tried his best to keep them alive. It was true that he was funny and honorable. It was true that I liked him. But he was a vampire, and he owned me. The thought of that was enough for me to have to open my mouth and pant out my fear. But at least it was still Stefan, and not Buonarrota. Not the Lord of Night. Stefan's bond had saved me again. Had I been free, I would probably belong to the other vampire right now. He could have used me to get whatever it was that he wanted from our pack and Marsilia. I could have been his Trojan horse. As the bus rattled on, I continued to play with various people's motivations as best I could. It wasn't really a waste of time. The exercise made me feel like I was doing something. Buonarrota had taken me because Wolf told him I was the most powerful person in the Tri-Cities. Why had Wolf done that? Maybe as a joke, but I didn't think so. It was probable, Stefan had told me not too long ago, that Wolf was in Marsilia's seethe as a spy.
But, he told me with a wry smile, I doubt that Buonarrota would approve of Wolf's methods. In his own way, Wolf is more devoted to Marsilia than any of her seed, more devoted to her than to the Lord of Night. Wolf is old and strange. Who knows how his mind works?
I had to agree about the strange, but I had some experience dealing with old and strange people. And I thought that Stefan might be well on target about how Wolf served Marsilia and let Buonarrota think Wolf served him instead. So Wolf had thrown me under the bus in order to do what? The first thing I thought of was that by taking me instead of, say, Stefan or one of Marsilia's other vampires, all of the werewolves would be fighting to get me back. If Wolf had given them Adam, I thought of Buonarrota trying to get Adam and was pretty sure that it would not have gone smoothly. Someone would have died, maybe many someones. But me? blindsided by a kidnapping done by vampires? I would not stand a chance. Not of avoiding capture, but I was good at surviving, wasn't I? And if I died, it wouldn't mean much to Wolf or Marsilia either. Not as long as Adam never found out the Wolf had set me up, anyway. Even so, Adam would take up Buonarrota before looking to Wolf. That felt right. Felt like a move Wolf might make. Once he knew that Buonarrota was moving against Marsilia at last, he'd want to consolidate her power, to put the werewolves firmly at her back. Wolf knew that I was tied to Stefan. Would he know that Buonarrota would have trouble breaking that tie? Yes, I thought. James Blackwood, the one the vampires called the Monster, had tried to break our bond and failed. If I came back from visiting Buonarrota unharmed, Wolf could set up some sort of test to discover if I were unwillingly working for Buonarrota. Probably would do so if I managed to escape cleanly. Somehow that made me feel better. Wolf would have figured out if I had been made Buonarrota's pet. So Buonarrota, operating on Wolf's very wolf-like information, had found himself holding a weak female instead of Marsilia's most powerful supporter. My tie to Stefan, that Buonarrota thought was to Marsilia, meant he couldn't use me as a puppet. So Buonarrota was left with a useless hostage. If he killed me outright, Bran Cornick, the Maroc, would declare war. To Bran and to the world, I was one of those he'd sworn to protect. If he didn't avenge me, he'd lose face. But an accident, that would simplify things greatly. He forgot to lock the door, and his half-crazed werewolf pet had torn me to bits. So sad. Tragic, even. I bet he would look very apologetic. His story would have worked to keep Bran off his back. Not that Bran would believe him, but without proof, Bran could not attack Buonarrota with impunity. Bran couldn't go after Buonarrota without starting a war with the other vampires. Such a war invited complications and disasters that might make World War I look like the jolly little war the British thought they were marching to. My death wouldn't endear him to Adam, though. But neither would my kidnapping have. If he wanted to use our neutral zone, then my kidnapping didn't make sense at all. But I remembered he'd been lying to me when he'd told me he was interested in a place where supernatural creatures and humans could interact safely. The bus braked hard, then started up again, in a low gear that vibrated nastily in the luggage compartment, and I momentarily lost my train of thought. It wasn't like I enjoyed picking apart the plans of super-villainous vampires, but the bus had been traveling for a long, long time, and it wasn't like there was anything else going on. And there was the minor, inconsequential motivation that my life was in the balance. No. Bran wouldn't go after Buonarrota without proof that left him clearly in the right. Adam might, but he didn't have Bran's resources. Buonarrota wouldn't be worried about Adam. He didn't know Adam like I did. For the moment, we had the upper hand. He'd underestimated me by a hair's breadth, because that's how close that chase with the werewolf had been. I'd escaped. But he couldn't allow me to stay free. He had to retake me to save face. No. He still needed me to die in order to save face and to come out on top. He wouldn't underestimate me again. I couldn't afford to underestimate him, either. I knew more about vampires than I'd ever wanted to. The old vampires operated like spiders, with webs strung all over their territory. A vampire like Buonarrota probably had people all over Europe. It wouldn't be hard to find me here. There weren't a lot of coyotes in Europe, probably none outside a zoo. He'd have people looking for my coyote self. I had to disappear. I put my head down on my paws and tried to ignore the diesel fumes. 4. Mercy. Still somewhere in Europe, stuck in the luggage compartment of a bus. I'm just lucky I'm not prone to car sickness. The bus continued moving for a very long time. Twice it stopped without opening the luggage doors, presumably to let people eat and take care of business. That I didn't have to figure out how to get out to take care of business probably meant that I was dehydrated. I was certainly hungry. But it was convenient, and my coyote body was better at dealing with less regular food and drink than my human one. When it stopped for the third time, I was ready to get out. Fortunately, this time the doors to my compartment opened with a screech of hinges. I pulled on Pack Magic, which answered my call sluggishly, but it was enough for me to scoot out of the luggage compartment and into the shadows of the twilight surrounding a tourist-friendly hotel. The bus had traveled all day. That meant I was approximately 500 miles from wherever in Italy I'd been to start with, give or take a couple of hundred miles. I could smell a freshwater river nearby, but not an ocean. There were no large mountains, but there seemed to be some rise and fall to the land. I found a place behind a pair of giant potted plants near the corner of the hotel that left me a dark shadow to hide in. With the Pack Magic to help, I didn't think anyone would see me as long as I wasn't moving. I took some time to examine my surroundings. Buildings rose all around me. Not skyscrapers, but 4 or 5 story buildings, most of which dated back a few centuries. I saw a street sign, and it had a few marks above the letters no romance language had, but it wasn't Cyrillic either, at least not any version of Cyrillic I was familiar with. After a few minutes of observation didn't help me figure out where I was, I took a tighter hold of the threads of Pack Magic, faint because my pack was a very long way away, and ventured out into the growing darkness. As I traveled through the city, heading for the origin of the scent of the river, the buildings got older, a lot older by centuries, and the streets turned to cobblestones. There were distinctive red tile roofs and artwork on the outside of buildings. Probably not frescoes, though that's what they looked like. My liberal arts education had given me enough of a basis in architecture that I could tell the difference between Gothic and Romanesque with about 70% accuracy. It did not tell me what it was called when there were designs all over the outer surface of a building. The overall effect was an exuberant, almost boisterous, eclectically historical architecture. Here and there, aggressively plain buildings squatted between the beautiful, centuries-old masterpieces, like defiant toads set between swans, hinting that this city had spent some time behind the Iron Curtain. I had my suspicions about where I was, but it wasn't until an hour later, when I'd found the river and looked down it to see the most famous and unmistakable of its many famous landmarks, the grand old medieval Charles Bridge, that I knew for certain where I was. Prague, the heart of Bohemia. I knew a little bit about Prague. The first thing that came to mind was that Prague citizens had a habit of throwing powerful officials out of windows. The second defenestration of Prague began the 30 Years' War in 1618. There wasn't another capital city with a first defenestration that I knew of, let alone a second one. Prague was full of my kind of people. By leaping a few low stone fences, I found a chunk of ground next to the riverbank. I couldn't remember the name of the river, except that it began with a V and that the Germans called it something else that reminded me of mold, tucked next to and around the edge of a restaurant that was hidden from the view of street, restaurant, and boats on the river. It was not particularly clean or lovely, but it was hidden, and that's all I would ask for tonight. And I lay there, in the hard-packed dirt, for maybe an hour, next to the river. After 10 minutes or so, I remembered it was the Vltava, 3 unlikely consonants in a row. I still couldn't remember the name the Germans called it. It was full dark, but there were lights all over the city that gave the river's graceful flow a surreal beauty. I knew that Stefan had given me good advice. I should just lie low and wait to be found. But I'd slept most of the day cramped up in the belly of the bus, and I was now too restless to sleep. There were werewolves in Prague. I knew that. The powerful beast of Gévaudan, who'd ruled most of Europe for centuries, had seen to it that the packs were few and far between, as he did not brook competition. In Spain, where Aziel de Mor had ruled, the beast had left them alone. But he had stayed away from certain other places, too. Milan, where the Lord of Night reigned supreme, had been one of them. I was pretty sure that Prague had been another. There was something about the werewolves in Prague I couldn't remember, something that urged me to caution. I hadn't expected to find myself in Europe, well, ever, really, so I hadn't paid much attention to them. The werewolf who ruled here was very, very old, like Marok or Azil old. I could remember that much. For some reason, I had the picture of a very hairy man in a medieval kitchen with his hirsute arms folded on the top of a rough-hewn wooden table in my head. It made me want to smile. Likely someone had been talking about him when I was a child, and I'd formed an idea of what he looked like. To have been alpha enough to keep Gévaudan at bay, he was doubtless a scary man. But I'd grown up with werewolves, and being a werewolf was an insufficient reason to be frightened of him. Even so, running around Prague was probably a bad idea until I could remember what I had heard about the local alpha that had worried me. I should stay where I was. I'd lived more than half my life essentially alone. Sometimes in the past few years, I had longed to be alone, just for an hour or two. And here I was, alone. Sometimes getting your wish really sucks. I still could not feel the pack bonds unless I was in a trance. My bond with Adam was faint, like a memory of the strong line of communication, or non-communication during its contrary moments. I tried not to notice the bond between Stefan and me, and since it, too, was faint, was mostly successful. Adam had traveled to Washington, D.C. several times during our marriage, and our mating bond had been strong and true, or as strong and true as ever, because it was eccentric. Given the current evidence, the pack magic must have provided the power to keep our bond going over the distance. Those dreams I'd had in the bus, I refused to believe they were only dreams. The first one might have been, I admitted reluctantly, though it had felt more real than most of my dreams. But the second one, the one with Stefan, that one was real. And if both Adam and Stefan said that they were on their way to Italy, I had to believe that was what was happening, to face Buonarrota. The Lord of Night had taken me from my mate, and now Adam was going to visit him. There was no way that was not going to be a disaster, not at all. What was everyone thinking to have allowed that to happen? Okay, granted that Adam made his own decisions, but Stefan had sounded so confident that as long as I remained at large, diplomacy could happen. My husband was not overly diplomatic under the best of circumstances. I had escaped the plans the Lord of Night had made for me. Neither he nor Adam was going to be in a good mood. I didn't see how this was going to work out without one of them dead, no matter what Stefan said. I knew very well that my friend Stefan could lie like a carny on a bally stage. I wasn't certain he couldn't lie to me, too, in order to spare me from worry. My internal lie detector was very good, but not infallible. I popped up to my feet. I could not sit around all night with nothing for company but my thoughts, kept there by some vague worry about the Alpha of Prague and the probability that I was, at this very moment, the subject of a deadly hunt by the most powerful vampire in, well, anywhere, I supposed. I left the backpack where it was, because my nose told me that people didn't come to that tiny forgotten corner of the restaurant grounds very often. My little bit of pack magic would have an easier time hiding me if I wasn't doing something remarkable, like carrying a backpack around. On 4 feet, I retraced my way back to the street and set out to explore a nighttime Prague with the faint concealment that the remnants of pack magic wrapped around me. I was in Prague, in the Czech Republic, and I'd never traveled out of the country before, except for that one crazy trip to Mexico with Char, during which we had avoided jail by the hair of our chinny-chin-chins because of Char's exquisitely horrible taste in men. So what if an old vampire was going to murder my husband? If I wasn't going to let myself be distracted, I might as well go curl up in a miserable ball and wait for Adam, or maybe Buonarrota or whatever his name, the Alpha of Prague, to find me. Wait to be rescued, Stefan had told me. Not very flattering in retrospect. I don't follow orders, even kindly given, and I wasn't going to wait around to be rescued like some helpless princess when there was exploring to do. Just then, I passed a restaurant or pub or something that had a sign in the window that said free Wi-Fi in about 10 languages. It would open at 11. I made note of it because my stolen e-reader and I needed free Wi-Fi. But it was a long time until 11 a.m., so I kept going. Eventually, I found myself in the famous Old Town Square with its fabulous clock tower that looked as though it had been transplanted from the Middle Ages. The rest of the buildings were, even to my relatively uneducated eyes, a mishmash of eras that seemed to blend together in a, well, a bohemian style. My favorite was a glorious old church or cathedral with Gothic, I think, towers whose spiky tops reached for the heavens and promised impalement to any angel who happened to fall down upon them. There were still a few people meandering about the open-air restaurants, though the actual commerce seemed to be finishing up. I moved slowly and stuck to the shadows, and no one stood up and pointed at the coyote in the middle of the city, so I was pretty sure that the "see what you expect to see and don't be alarmed" part of the pack spell was working okay. Narrow cobblestone streets led off from the square in a higgledy-piggledy fashion that had nothing to do with convenience and everything to do with their medieval origin. Charmed, I started down one at random. Like the square, the street was cobblestone, the road barely wide enough to accommodate a single car or small delivery van. My feet, still sore from running from the werewolf, would have preferred a nice grassy verge to the granite cobbles. But the rest of me? The only thing that would have made my first exposure to medieval Prague better would have been if Adam were by my side. I was in Prague, walking down cobblestones through a street that probably looked a lot like this 1,000 years ago. Granted, it wouldn't have smelled like this. Medieval cities had to cope with the waste of horses, cattle, sheep, and geese, not to mention people. And mostly, by modern standards, they failed. I was most content with this version of the Middle Ages. My tongue lolled out in pleasure, not even sore feet or being hunted by vampires could impact. Cobblestones had been necessary in the Middle Ages, a huge upgrade from dirt, waste, mud. Cobbles could be washed clean and swept. They didn't get the nasty ruts that could deepen until they trapped any cart with the misfortune to fall into them. I trotted past closed tourist shops filled with an unlikely mix of chandeliers and alcohol and t-shirts situated next to antique shops. Good heavens, was that an absinthe shop? And jewelry stores that specialized in amber and garnets. The absinthe shop had a neon green t-shirt in the window that read, "Absinthe maketh the heart grow fonder," which was a little too close to my situation to be comfortable. There was a lot of English around, from the t-shirt to the signs in the windows. There was a lot of graffiti, too, which surprised me for some stupid reason. In the Tri-Cities, we fight the good fight against graffiti. Most of it is gang-related, but some is just teenagers striving to make their mark in an indifferent world. I guess graffiti seemed like it was exclusively a New World problem, which was a stupid assumption. I knew that there was graffiti that dated back to the Romans and said largely the same kinds of things that our modern graffiti does. "Your sister sleeps with gladiators," "I was here," "Flavius is hot," that kind of thing. Maybe the narrowness of the street had to do with defense. You wouldn't have to do much to block such a narrow lane and keep armies trapped in small spaces where hot grease or tar and arrows or rocks could be flung on their heads with very little work. And right in the middle of envisioning medieval battles, I caught the scent of werewolf in the air. Musk and mint and yeast, which wasn't a usual werewolf scent. I turned and trotted as silently as I could back down the street, but I wasn't silent enough. Someone trotted after me. A fit young-looking man in baggy pants and a skin-tight muscle shirt. I was suddenly glad the pack magic that kept most people from noticing me was as thin as it was, because though most werewolves can't actually feel the magic that makes their lives so much easier, if I'd been covered with it, as I might have been in the Tri-Cities, he probably would have noticed. As it was, he saw me plenty clearly. I hadn't seen a single stray dog since I'd started my adventure tonight, though I could smell that there were a lot of dogs around. I think that's what he thought I was. He was being a good citizen and helping the poor stray dog, nice werewolf that he was. He sped up, and I didn't dare do so. Never run from werewolves. It only makes them hungry. He said something soothing. It might have been in Czech or Slovak, but here, puppy, is a phrase that needs no translation. A four-board-wide fence spanned a rare space between two buildings. I paid little attention to it when I passed it the first time, except to note the dark green splatter of graffiti that was no more legible for being in Czech than the graffiti was at home. Now I was happy to note that the fence was level, top and bottom, but the ground had a little swell on one side. So there was a space just big enough for a coyote to slide underneath with enough panache that it looked like I'd done it before. See, I am a dog going home, not the foreign maid of a foreign alpha running away from a nice werewolf. I found myself in a garden that was much bigger than the four-board fence had made it appear, because the garden extended along the space between the two buildings and into a back area that was pretty and green. There was a dog in the garden, a very big dog who couldn't have squeezed out the hole I'd squeezed in through. The large female mastiff came around the corner of the building just as my follower grabbed the top of the fence and chinned himself up to look over the fence. The werewolf probably thought I smelled weird. It is hard to smell yourself. But I'd been in an accident, been hauled to Italy, smuggled myself aboard a diesel bus, then traveled halfway across Europe. Interesting was probably a light word for what I smelled like. Maybe he'd caught a whiff of pack, but since I could hardly feel them, I didn't think so. The mastiff, bless her, welcomed me into her yard like a golden retriever welcoming a burglar into his home, that is to say, with a wagging tail and licks of affection. That is not my usual experience with mastiffs, but I wasn't going to complain. The werewolf in human form laughed, dropped off the fence, and patted it. He said something cheerful and quiet, and he left. I snuggled against the lonely mastiff for maybe a half hour before getting up from her side and sliding back under the fence. She didn't notice my going. Her quiet snores made me feel guilty, like a lover who sneaks away in the night. I was comforted by her sleek, well-groomed body. Someone loved her. I checked the fence from habit, and yes, I'd left some fur behind, but that couldn't be helped short of changing back to human and cleaning the bottom of the boards, naked. So I ignored it and walked off thoughtfully and painfully. I was becoming less pleased with the cobblestones with every step. I probably would have returned to my camping spot, but I didn't want to go straight back to where my purloined backpack was. I was being paranoid, but paranoia was a good thing. The Lord of Night was after me. The circuitous route back to the restaurant took me through the old Jewish quarter. I knew that because there were lots of signs for lost English-speaking tourists like me to follow, and because of the old new synagogue. The old new synagogue was about 600 years old or so, which made it the oldest operating synagogue in Europe. I only remembered all of that because I thought the name was funny. I'd wondered about the old, old synagogue, but I guess the name was a translation error, and there wasn't one. Still, it was an awesome name, and the building was interesting looking. 600 years old. I stared at it and tried to imagine how it would feel to be Bran or the Moor, and look at such things and remember before they were built. To look around the city and realize that the oldest thing in this old city was probably you. Adam would be there someday, assuming nothing killed him before then. I don't know about me. I don't think anyone does. My half-brother, who is also Coyote's child, says that sometimes we live a long time, half-mortal and half-avatar or Manitou or whatever Coyote and his kindred spirits are. Coyote told me I was too caught up in naming things, which is an excuse to not understand them. I had a few names for Coyote that I was too polite to use. I was trotting down a very narrow back street, this one less touristy than the first few I'd found, when, between one step and the next, every hair on my body rose. I shrank down against the wall I'd been walking by, trying to hide myself between a step and a garbage can. Magic swept through the street and paused by me. Magic, and something that called to my supernatural nature in a way I'd never felt before. My hiding place had not worked, so I stepped out to face a ghost. I have an affinity for ghosts, something I inherited from my father in addition to being able to change into a coyote. I see them when other people don't. I used to think I knew a lot about ghosts, but I'd started to believe that no one did. I generally tried not to pay attention to the ghosts because it made them pay attention back. This one waited with the same utter stillness I'd seen in Stefan and a few other vampires. But it wasn't the ghost of a vampire. Yes, there are such things. It wasn't anything I'd ever seen before. I'd never seen a ghost that could hold as much magic as this one did. Darkness gathered around it, giving it size without form. 10 feet at least, maybe a little more. There was a heaviness about it. It felt dense. The weight of the magic it held, a weave of magic filled in part with a kind of power I'd never felt before, made it difficult to breathe. Some of the energy felt very familiar, but I couldn't place it. It wasn't fey magic or witchcraft. Maybe if it hadn't been entwined with a totally alien feel of the other magic, I could have placed where I'd felt it before. I took another step, and the mist of magic touched my feet, washing over me with a strange, clean warmth. It should have scared me, that feeling. Whenever any magic feels good, that's the time to worry. But, alone in a strange city with the monsters hunting me, I closed my eyes, and the shadow pulled away the weariness, the pain, and the fear that I'd been battling since I woke up in the house of the Lord of Night. It fed me comfort and energy and light, and it fed from me, too. At the time, caught in its magic, I didn't care. I felt the magic brush the bonds I shared with Adam in the pack and hesitate on that other bond. Impulsively, I took my human shape and stood before the ghost of Prague's past with my hands open and outstretched. "I mean no harm to you or yours," I told it. It did not feel male or female to me. To my human eyes, it was even less clearly defined. There was no reason to suppose that it spoke English. But the words had come to my tongue by instinct. As a coyote shapeshifter, I trusted my instincts more than most people did. Ghosts generally could understand me no matter what language I spoke. It contemplated me for a moment more, then cried out hoarsely, a sound of rage and frustration and loneliness that should have shook the windows in the nearby buildings, but didn't. No one came to see what caused the noise. Runnels of magic slid down my face, as if it had taken a swipe at me with claws. The sensation dug into my bones like hot metal, almost as shocking as the wrenching twist from warm delight to fear. Then the whole thing, magic and all, slowly dissipated. For one instant, I glimpsed something glowing on the center of its forehead, letters that disappeared before the last of the magic. Not letters in any alphabet I knew, though they resembled two oddly written N's and an X. It could have been Arabic or Russian, but I was pretty sure it was Hebrew, and that the three letters together spelled Emmet, truth. Because I had just met the Golem of Prague, or what was left of him anyway. What other giant ghost would be wandering the streets of Prague in the Jewish quarter in the middle of the night radiating magic but the most famous local legend? In the 16th century, a revered and learned rabbi named Judah Lov ben Bezalel, disturbed by a series of attacks on the people living in the Jewish quarter, created a golem, a giant creature made of clay. On the creature's forehead, he inscribed the word for truth. In so much, all of the accounts agreed. The end of the story was another matter. In some versions, the rabbi lost control of the golem and was forced to destroy it. In another, the creature fell in love, and nothing good ever comes, in stories, from a monster's falling in love. In yet another variation, when the rabbi died, the golem retreated to the attic of the old new synagogue and lay down to wait for his master to return. A lot of the stories end with the golem's clay body remaining in the attic of the old new synagogue, a room reachable only from the outside of the building. I thought it unlikely that it was still there. if it ever had been. Prague had been occupied by the Nazis, after all. Hitler, who had been obsessed with all things magical, must